Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. The Brian Koberger court drama appears to be over after he pleaded guilty to quadruple murder last week in Idaho. Attorney Belin Myers with Belin Myers Law in Idaho joins us to talk about that. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here and join the conversation.
So now that sentencing is set for July 23rd and the death penalty is officially off the table, what does that tell us about how both sides were reading the case? And do you think it suggests that there were risks that each side wanted to avoid before going to trial?
As a defense attorney, this move signals what I often see in high stakes cases. Both sides weighed the emotional cost, the public exposure, and the unpredictability of a jury trial. The prosecution likely wanted to avoid re-traumatizing the victims' families and avoiding the uncertainty and the long and arduous process of a capital trial, which comes often with appeals. The defense likely saw strong forensic evidence and a high likelihood of conviction, unfortunately. It's unfortunate for the victims who, the victims' families who were hoping for a trial. I know there is a family who has been quite outspoken, but I do believe that this outcome does reflect the reality that even in emotionally charged cases, both sides may choose certainty and closure over spectacle and risk. And certainly, the families will be heard, but they will be heard at sentencing.
No death penalty, life in prison without the possibility of parole, no right to appeal. Is that a typical deal?
It's fairly common in capital cases for plea deals to include a full waiver of appeal, of the appeals process, because prosecutors do want finality, right? If they're going to be offering a plea deal, they're looking for closure for these victims, families. And when the defense team agrees to those terms, I believe it does tell me that they also saw that there was likely no viable path to acquittal and wanted to protect their client from death. So in that context, I don't believe this deal was just strategic. I believe it was likely a last lifeline.
Well, who do you think approached who? I mean, it's impossible to tell, really, but, you know, who saw the weakness in their case to approach the other side? Or might it have been they both, as you stated earlier, saw some liabilities and wanted the certainty of a deal now versus rolling your dice with the jury?
Right. It's difficult to say. Typically, in plea deals, the prosecutor is the one who offers a plea deal, and the defense has the option of accepting the plea deal or negotiating. That's where the lawyering skills come in, or electing to go to a jury trial. So it's difficult to say, but typically the prosecutor offers the defense the option of a plea deal. And certainly they did take the death penalty off the table. So it would be likely that the state of Idaho is the one who elected to do so.
Footage shows Koberger saying yes calmly and without much emotion when asked if he planned and carried out the killings. And we saw his parents also remain expressionless. From a defense standpoint, how does that kind of reaction in your mind impact sentencing? And can staying quiet and unreadable help defendants in this situation, or could it make them seem cold and uncaring?
Well, demeanor matters, right? Especially in a case this brutal and a case with such high public exposure. And judges are human too. They do look for remorse, even subtle signs. His flat effect could be seen as calm acceptance or cold indifference. I mean, he just committed to killing four innocent human beings. And so I don't believe it will change the life sentence, but it absolutely affects public perception and may influence the tone of the judge's remarks at sentencing.
Well, speaking of public perception, obviously this case got a ton of notoriety around the world. How much do you think that affected the decision to plead it out? You know, that could go both ways. Certainly, we've seen lots of examples recently of high-profile defendants, criminal cases, get sympathy from juries, right? We saw that recently in the Karen Reed case. So, you know, perhaps the defense was intimidated by the media. Perhaps they were also emboldened by it, thinking that, you know, we can get some sympathy. Although, you know, facts in this case were very different and the evidence seemed much stronger against Kohlberger than Karen Reed. But how do you think the media attention affected both sides' decision to plea this out?
Well, I absolutely think, you know, it did take into account. Certainly, there was a motion filed from the defense to delay the trial because of a recent Dateline episode where there was some leaks, and the judge took it a step further in, I believe he said a special prosecutor would be ordered to find out who the culprit of the leak was. So certainly the public's scrutiny had to have had a play in my mind, especially if there are leaks in what will come out at evidence. Certainly that can be a technique of voir dire. We can question potential jurors. But I believe that the defense has handled this case calculated and quiet. I do believe it was intentional, very contrary to the Karen Reed team. Certainly a different set of facts, but I believe it was intentional in these high profile cases. I believe controlling the narrative is critical. And from the defense's side, it was just a focus on courtroom strategy that potentially did play well. They were able to secure, you know, life for their client, which is, I think we were all shocked by that news. So in terms of the defense, I think that they did a great job in filing pretrial motions. And I think, you know, of course, the public's perception, as a defense attorney myself, you know, the public tends to think that we are defending, you know, a killer. No, we're defending the Constitution. And I think the ball was in their court in that sense. So I think that it played out well. I believe that justice is going to be served for both sides. Like I said, a case this public is got to be traumatizing for the families of these victims to hear, you know, the just gory details. So I definitely think that that took a play.
About the reactions to your last point about the families and how traumatizing this is, what do we know about how the families have reacted since the developments earlier this month?
Right. Well, justice and closure, unfortunately, don't always look the same. This family is grieving, and it's difficult to start the grieving process, you know, with years of appeals, because there's not the sense of finality. They're going to be grieving every day of their lives. And I do believe that, if I'm not mistaken, at least one of the families was came out publicly. Their attorney said that they were in favor of the plea deal that the prosecution and the defense reached in this case. But there is, I believe, the Goncalves family, who the father, who is very outspoken, and he believes that justice was not served, which he is a grieving father, and he has every right to feel the way that he does. But I believe that the prosecution does have to weigh all of the victims' families' wishes, in addition to the finality. This Brian Kohlberger has pled to all four counts of murder. He is accepting consecutive life sentences for these heinous crimes that he committed. And I believe the sense of he waiving his appeal rights can hopefully bring some closure to these families so that they can find peace.
Well, one problem with the deal, though, is we don't have a motive, right? And we'll never know, it sounds like. I think the police have said that they will reveal what they found out in the investigation, but I don't know that they have come up with a motive. I don't know. But if I was a family member, that would be one of the major problems I have with this deal, is that we'll never get closure on why this monster took the lives of four of these young people.
Absolutely. And that's something that we all have questions, right? I have questions too. What was the motive? Why four murders just in cold blood? Why them? And I think, unfortunately, these are questions that we may not get answers to. Everyone is going to be looking on July 23rd for that sentencing date. Brian Koberger will have the opportunity to speak at sentencing if he elects to. Certainly the families will have their right to prepare victim impact statements. I believe they've set a whole day out for all the family members, the victims' families, multiple family members to explain how they feel. But I don't know if Brian Koberger will give us the why. I doubt it. Unfortunately, many defendants, don't spill the details as to why, but at the end of the day, I think it doesn't even matter why. There is no justification for taking the lives of these four beautiful, I say kids, but they were college students. They were there to better themselves, to better their education, and looking towards, they had a hopeful future. They had their whole lives ahead of us. So in a sense, I'm hoping that these families can come to terms with, they may not understand or even get to hear why. But at least justice will be served in the sense of he'll have the rest of his life behind bars, and hopefully they can start the healing process.
Well, I had one last question. Your social media game is strong. You're all over Instagram, great marketing. How important is that to your practice, particularly being in a smaller market like where you are in Idaho, and also in your practice, criminal defense? Are you ever concerned that, potential jurors could be looking at social media, maybe getting the wrong sense of what you're doing? Again, understanding that, you've got great things on social media.
Thank you. Yes, I believe I went to school. My undergraduate degree at the College of Idaho was in business and marketing. And certainly the world of marketing has changed. A lot of law firms, lawyers are now marketing on social media. I believe social media is the way. It is it's accessible to everyone. It's free to download Instagram and post a video. And a lot of people are now looking for news. There was a statistic the other day that a lot of, the Gen Z and millennials are now looking for lawyers, doctors, dentists, accountants on Instagram. So I think it's very important to maintain a presence on Instagram, but also keeping it very professional at the same time. And it's finding that balance, knowing that potential, clients, but opposing counsel and also judges may be watching my videos. Definitely, makes me believe that professionalism is always key in being able to have a fun online presence and also keep it serious when the time is meant.
Well, if you're looking for expert legal counsel and you're in Idaho, Belyn Myers Law is here for you. I'm looking at it right there. And I bet you that if you represent someone, they get a picture under that sweet sign you've got over your head right now, that neon sign. So Belyn Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you all for having me on today. And
you are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
A couple of weeks ago, a lawsuit was filed against MIT, that's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, over what's being called severe and pervasive Jew hatred at the school. The 71-page complaint was filed by the Louis Brandeis Center for Human Rights under law. Paul Eccles is the firm's senior litigation counsel, and he joins us today to talk about it. Thanks so much for joining us on LFO.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, 71-page complaint. Give us the background. What prompted you to take on MIT, and What are the allegations and what are the legal grounds upon which you're basing your allegations?
Yeah, so start with a little context. We're a civil rights organization focused on anti-Semitism, particularly in education, and we receive legions of tips and complaints from kids around the country about anti-Semitism issues on their campuses. And the vast majority of them, while all serious, don't result in us actually filing a federal lawsuit. You know, the reason we took the significant step of filing a federal lawsuit here is because the problem on the MIT campus is particularly severe, pervasive, egregious. And most significantly under the law, it's gone unchecked by the MIT administration. The legal ground that we primarily rely upon is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I think most people are familiar with Title VII, which deals with discrimination in employment. Title VI is part of the same statute and deals with discrimination by institutions receiving federal funding. And it protects students at our nation's colleges, which all receive some type of federal funding, from discrimination and harassment based on a protected category, which includes race and natural origin, as well as a person's shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics. And we believe that MIT has violated its duties under Title VI to protect the Jewish members of the MIT community.
Well, this case involves allegations of anti-Semitism on campus during a time of intense political and social unrest. Can we unpack a little bit more against this backdrop where you believe MIT failed in its legal obligations to its students?
Absolutely. I think the root cause of the problem is that the university is not made dealing with anti-Semitism a priority. And the problem predated October 7, but has continued and escalated after October 7 and with what we're seeing going on in the Middle East. And it's at its essence, it has failed to create a climate in which it makes clear that anti-Semitism won't be tolerated. It's failed to enforce its own rules and policies to protect Jews and Israelis on its campus. It's failed to discipline those who target and harass Jews and Israelis on its campus. And in our complaint, we detail how there's a broad systemic problem with all kinds of incidents. But we also highlight the story of two particular members of the Jewish community on the campus, a grad student and a postdoc, who were each targeted and repeatedly harassed by an MIT professor. It was happened in a very public way, and they repeatedly complained to the MIT administration about it, and the administration sat on its hands, allowed it to continue. They did nothing to discipline the harasser, and one of our clients was essentially driven out of the university.
Paul, college campuses are supposed to be, bastions of First Amendment, and free speech is protected there, as is it is everywhere else in the country, but particularly on college campuses, free expression, free exchange of ideas is prized. Why is what was going on at MIT not protected by the First Amendment, or why shouldn't it be?
We hear the First Amendment from our adversaries all the time, and we want to highlight and repeat that our lawsuits do not seek to suppress free speech or prevent anyone from criticizing Israel's policies or how it has conducted itself in any of the wars in the Middle East. That's not what this lawsuit is about. It's not what any of our lawsuits are about. But two related points. One is that on these campuses, including MIT, we see a lot of ugly speech that is aimed at Zionists, which is being used as a thinly veiled pretext for Jew. And universities are great at recognizing dog whistles when they're directed at other protected groups, but they largely sit on their hands when it's directed at Jews. Second point is that While some ugly, hateful speech may be protected by the First Amendment, that does not alleviate a school's duty under Title VI to take steps to ensure Jews are not subjected to a hostile environment. They can condemn hate speech, even when protected by the First Amendment, and they can proactively provide support to the Jewish and Israeli community to make sure that they're supported.
What kind of response have you gotten to the lawsuit?
Other than a pro forma statement that it will defend itself in court, the response so far has been silence, which, as detailed in our complaint, is consistent with how MIT generally deals with complaints of anti-Semitism.
Well, MIT did act in response to attacks on their DEI program. They shut down their DEI office. You know, the Trump administration's fight against universities who they say peddle in anti-Semitism, most notably Columbia and Harvard, that's been well covered. How much is that influencing your decision, and how do you think that will affect the success of what you're doing?
I think what the Trump administration is doing is in parallel, in some ways following what we're doing. We've been active in the space, you know, long before President Trump started his second administration. We actually had a lawsuit against Harvard dealing with anti-Semitism before the current administration began its attack on Harvard relating to anti-Semitism issues. So what we do is based on what we learn, clients that come to us, when we find a compelling problem that warrants escalating it to the level of a federal lawsuit, we take action.
All right. I've got a question here. You're a graduate of University of Notre Dame and earned a JD from UCLA. So who are we rooting for this college football season?
Definitely Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Definitely. I had a feeling. I didn't see any Golden Domer stuff behind you, so I wasn't quite sure. Paul Eccles with Brandeis Center, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
I appreciate it, guys.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. A Brooklyn judge ruled that dogs are not just property. There's an emotional toll when they're lost. This stems from a pretty awful story about a dog being run over a couple years ago. Here to talk more about it with us is Christopher Berry, the executive director for the Non-Human Rights Project, responsible for overseeing action to secure legal rights for animals through litigation, legislation, education, and other efforts. Thank you, Christopher, for jumping on with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Christopher, let's give some context here. The dog in question was named Duke. He was being walked back in July of 2023 by a woman named Nan DeBlase, who was walking the dog who belonged to her son. A driver blew through a stop sign. She got out of the way. The car, unfortunately, hit the dog, and the dog didn't survive. The dog, importantly, as we'll learn about in a moment, was leashed at the time, was being walked by Nan with a leash. And a few days later, the owner, her son, posted on Instagram that how distraught he was. Can't believe he's writing that his dog is gone. They, both of them actually bought dogs after that. But of course, as a dog owner myself, you know that you can't replace one dog just by buying another. So he was really distraught. The family brought a lawsuit against the driver, alleging that they should be able to recover more than the standard damages. Most states recognize animals only as property. And you can only recover the value of the dog, plus in some states you can recover medical bills. This family wanted to expand the law and get the judge to recognize how devastating a loss a dog death could be, as recognize them as members of the family. Pick it up from there. The court encouraged organizations like yours to file amicus briefs. Surprisingly, some groups that we would have thought would be sympathetic to the cause of the family, like the American Kennel Club, filed briefs in opposition to expanding these rights. Explain to it, pick it up from that point if you can.
Yeah. So trade organizations like the American Veterinary Medical Association, American Kennel Club, opposed it. And the reason for that is fundamentally those are professional trade groups. So even though there's a connection with animal welfare and having pets in your family, fundamentally those organizations exist to protect the professionals from liability. So, veterinarians have made this argument, for example, that if you could recover emotional distress damages, go beyond the market value of the animal, that would increase insurance premiums for veterinarian practices. However, a study was done on that a while ago that showed that the actual premium increase would only account to something like 15 cents or so for every individual who uses veterinary services. So the costs are very small and marginal. I think it's really making a mountain out of a molehill.
So traditionally, Christopher, you can recover for the loss of a human if you were, for emotional distress following an incident like this, if you were within the zone of danger. Explain to us what that concept means and why it was expanded to animals in this particular case.
Yeah, well, so there's, the fundamental purpose of, tort law, right? This is where if someone wrongly injures you, you're able to be compensated with money for any non-lawyers listening. Fundamental purpose is to fully compensate someone who has been wronged. And that could be subject to abuse with different forms of property. You could say that the destruction of, scratching your car really ruined your day and, caused you to break up with your girlfriend or something, and that, people could really make a big deal about this. So in general, the idea is that we should limit recovery for emotional distress in cases of damage to property. And usually that makes sense, but it doesn't make sense anymore with regards to companion animals or pets, because people don't own pets as some sort of just a piece of property. Like, they're really socially, we're all bonded with our dogs and our cats, and so people have quite a bit of emotional investment in it that's not true of normal property. They're essentially part of the family. They're not just a piece of furniture in the house.
And Christopher, you mentioned companion animals. We want our listeners and viewers to understand this was not like a service animal. This was just a regular pet that this young man had. That was obviously very close to him. How important was the fact that this dog, was in the wedding, for example, he was wearing, there's a big, very relevant was the fact that the dog wore a tuxedo in the owner's wedding. And also, like we talked about, the fact that he was tethered to the woman when this incident happened. Those were both salient points for the judge, correct?
Yeah, and I think there's sort of two categories there, right? We have the fact that that Duke was part of the wedding. Additionally, another fact that you didn't mention is that there was actually video footage of this incident. So there's security footage that head on of this car going through and striking and killing Duke. So the evidence and the emotional gravity couldn't have been greater in this case, that evidence. And I think that for anyone who has empathy or has a bond with, a dog or other companion animal themselves, it's hard not to really empathize with that. And so I think what we see there is the judge realizing how important this was and how Duke wasn't just a thing. Duke really was truly and reasonably treated like a member of the family. And then you have this other important fact that you mentioned, which was that Duke was leashed at the time. The reason that's important is because there is prior case law in the state of New York limiting the availability of emotional distress damages in cases involving companion animals. And the judge I think quite smartly and had to do this, made the ruling very narrow, highlighting the fact that in this case, Duke was not only a member of the family, but was also leashed. And that made the immediacy or the danger to the person walking Duke across the crosswalk much more, immediate and threatening to them. So that was a distinguishing factor. I think on appeal, I would hope that the appellate courts who look at this, there's already been an appeal filed. I hope the appellate courts look past that. I don't know that that is necessarily should be a key distinguishing mark, but it was a very narrow ruling in this case.
Chrissy, even this ruling has, it's pretty specific to this case. The judge really went out of their way, I think, to explain that there were some carve-outs and these, specifics of this case. Even if they win on appeal, it's questionable whether you can apply this to most cases like this. And, this has been often litigated, and generally the plaintiffs are losing these kind of cases. My question to you is, why are judges, why are courts so reluctant to recognize what seems obvious, not just because I'm a dog lover and a dog owner, but I think to any sort of, level-minded person, that animals are like a big part of people's lives and they should all arguably be afforded more protection than a human because they don't have any ability to protect themselves. They're totally reliant on humans. So arguably, they should be given the same rights as humans in some respects, but greater rights because they're so defenseless.
Yeah, I think you're hitting something that's very true there, and it's quite an I'll say quite a strange dynamic to see courts be so reluctant to recognize this. To it, in my view, this is just saying that Duke was a part of the family is like saying the sky is blue. So what's the I don't fully understand the reluctance. I think where it's coming from is we have these competing values in our legal system, right? On the one hand, we want predictability and stability. But on the other hand, we also want justice to be done. We want fairness. We want things to feel equitable. And these cases are really sort of challenging the court to pick one side, right? Do you want to stick with tradition and act the way that courts were in the 1700s and 1800s when we didn't even know animals were sentient, where dogs were more likely to be like an equivalent of an electronic security system? Right back in the 1700s, they would bark when someone entered the property to warn the residents of the house. Or are animals, more like family members? And so there's this question of how do we apply this legal principle of fairly compensating the victims of wrongdoing? How do we apply that today? Do we stick with the old rule, or do we say that the sky is blue? And I think there should be a high bar for sort of switching gears there, but that high bar is met here.
Christopher, last question we have, we want to hear more about your organization. We've covered these cases. The Happy the Elephant case got a lot of notoriety. We covered that one when it came out. But tell us more about the Non-Human Rights Project and ultimately what your goals are.
Yeah, the Non-Human Rights Project, our mission is to secure legal rights for non-human animals. And really, it's based on the view that the law really should be tailored to the capability of the individual, their experience. It should reflect reality, and not just an arbitrary species distinction, right? Like not privileging humans simply because they're human, but because for the right to vote, for example, like we understand what we're doing when an adult human votes, right? So, to the extent that we're distinguishing between humans and animals, it should be based on really the capability of the individual and not just purely species membership. And so I think that that's really important here, right? That that we have a judge who is willing to look at the legal principle, right? Fair compensation when someone's been injured and realize and recognize that just because Duke was a dog, that doesn't mean that he's not a part of the family. In Happy's case, we had argued that the law cares about liberty, and it cares about liberty because it wants to respect autonomy. We argue that and provided hundreds of pages of evidence that Happy is cognitively autonomous, that she appreciates and cares about her liberty and that she suffers when she's exploited and held in unnatural conditions and that she should go to a sanctuary, right? So just because she's an elephant, that doesn't mean that the court shouldn't recognize that there's an actual liberty interest there. And so fundamentally, that's sort of the common thread that connects our work on behalf of Happy to get her to a sanctuary, in this case involving the dog, which is, again, just that court should be applying the principle, like we care about liberty, we want to compensate victims of wrongdoing, and then say the sky is blue when it is. And in this, you know, in Happy's case, she is cognitively autonomous. And I'll just say one other thing is that unfortunately, courts aren't even really engaging with that evidence. And in a lot of cases, what they're saying is that we can't do anything. We have no power to do anything here. It has to go to the legislature. And while I agree that the legislature could do something, there are already existing laws that say liberty matters, and our legal system protects liberty, protects people from unlawful confinement. And so when someone like Happy is suffering because of a wrongful or unlawful confinement, the court should at least examine that evidence and let's have that debate. I'm confident we would win it, but courts aren't even getting to that level of like, well, what do we owe and like, what are her capabilities?
Christopher, we got to go, but was Judge Maslow a dog owner? Do we know?
I don't know. As a dog owner myself, I certainly feel sort of a social pack obligation to be fair to dogs. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was. I mean, dogs love us and they're so loyal to us. They deserve to be, respect and recognition of status from our legal system in return.
The website is nonhumanrights.org. You can find out more information. I've also been seeing people donating even as we've been speaking. So the mission continues. Christopher Berry, we really appreciate you joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Well, if you've ever wanted to know the secrets of the prenups of the super wealthy, we got a guy who can give you all the dirt. Attorney Robert Cohen with Cohen, Clare, Lands, Griefer, and Simpson is one of America's leading matrimonial lawyers. He's based in New York. Well, it's where he was based. You're not there right now, correct?
No, I'm upstate New York. I'm at my vacation house.
But you've handled cases in Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, New Jersey, Missouri, state of Washington, even in Europe. And his firm handles dozens of prenups annually for clients worth over $100 million. Thanks so much for coming on.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Robert, really relevant in light of the marriage last week of Jeff Bezos, the richest man on the planet. So talk to us about prenups for the ultra, ultra wealthy for people like Bezos. Do you think one was involved here? What does that look like? How long does it take to put that together? Talk to us about that.
So every state in the United States has its own rules on prenups. I'm going to try to talk generally about what a prenup should do and how you should do it. The reality is that everybody with wealth has a prenup today. Nobody in their right mind would get married without a prenup, particularly the billionaires. And it used to be millionaires, now it's billionaires. So everybody has a prenup. And you got to conform to the laws of the state that the parties are in. And in many cases, the parties don't know where they're going to live for the rest of their life. So you have to get into where they might be living. And we just did one recently. There were 8 jurisdictions that we had to get lawyers involved in to make sure that the prenup was going to be valid in that jurisdiction. The one thing you want to make sure is that you have a valid prenup and that conforms to the law of the states that you think are going to have jurisdiction.
Dharam, I just want to ask you a follow-up, because you said anyone who didn't get a prenup would be out of their mind. So this sort of antiquated notion of, well, let's be romantic and not approach this, you know, possibility of this marriage failing at the beginning, that goes out the window with even regular people, not to even mention Jeff Bezos, right? There's no way that would happen.
50% of the people who get married get divorced. And there's no difference between first, second, and third marriages. So you just need to look at the statistics, and then you'll reach the conclusion that you need a prenup. In Europe, in Eastern Europe, the divorce rate is even higher. So you got to have a prenup.
Robert Bezos built Amazon before his first marriage ended, and his ex ended up getting 25% of his stake. When a billionaire remarries, how do you suggest protecting future growth and not just what has already been created?
So most jurisdictions will allow you to waive the appreciation of the assets. So somebody like Mr. Bezos, and I didn't handle the Bezos prenups, somebody like Mr. Bezos must protect the appreciation and the growth of the assets that he has. Amazon must grow every day. I think we don't go shopping anymore. We just call Amazon. So you can protect that in most jurisdictions. And we do that as a matter of course.
The interesting thing about the very wealthy prenup is that, you know, it's very common for someone who is very wealthy to marry someone else, sort of either very wealthy or maybe wealthier. How does that affect prenups? In other words, if Lauren Sanchez, in this case, came into the marriage and she was, you know, I think she was a reporter, weather person in LA for many years, so presumably had some wealth, not to the extent of Bezos, but how does that affect prenups when the other party is also well off?
Well, if both parties came into a marriage with significant wealth, you could have an agreement that provides that neither party gets anything from the other party. Now, life doesn't work that way generally, but you could provide that, certainly in New York, and that would work. So you have a lot more flexibility in the agreement when both spouses got a lot of dough. In some cases, it gets more complicated because the spouse with slightly less money may want to even the score and have as much money as the person she's marrying. So then you get into doing that kind of stuff. But you got a lot more flexibility when both parties have money. I don't know anything about Mrs. Sanchez's wealth, but it strikes me that she doesn't have anything near what Mr. Bezos might have. And they would have a prenup, which gives her something at the end of the day, if the end of the day ends in a divorce or death. You can deal with death provisions too. Most states, there's an automatic right to inherit, and you can waive those or you can diminish those as well. And I'm sure the Bezos office did that, because I think he has children from a prior marriage, and he'd want to make sure those children are protected as well.
So, Robert, you've worked with some of the most high-profile clients in the world. Without naming names, what's the most complicated asset or clause that you've had to deal with in a prenup?
Well, the most complicated clause I had was a silly clause in which the spouse with the money tried to control the weight of the person he was marrying. And so there was a provision that she would lose significant wealth from him if she weighed more than X dollars. And it was a preposterous decision, but I was representing the person with the less wealth. And I mean, she couldn't use me as a lawyer if she was going to sign a provision like that. It was a woman in the case. It could be the opposite as well. But most of the time you have sophisticated lawyers and nobody does silly things in a prenup. You want to make sure, the thing that you want to make sure most of is that there's not going to be any litigation at the end of the day. You can't stop litigation from happening, but you could make the prenup sort of foolproof and make it proof of any legal challenge. And that's the important thing. Wealthy people don't want to be stuck in litigation about their wealth. The last thing they want to be stuck with.
Robert, Dwight Howard, who's a very well-known basketball player, Hall of Famer, news yesterday was that his wife filed for divorce after only being married for 6 months to Dwight Howard.
Is there any way to get out of a prenup, and is it more difficult or is it easier to do so among the ultra wealthy?
Most jurisdictions, it is very difficult to get out of a prenup. New York, for example, is an important commercial state. In states that are commercial, they protect contracts. And a prenup is nothing more than a contract. It happens to be a contract between people getting married. But this, our state will protect them. California will protect them. And California's got a community property. Illinois, for example, where you're located, has an equitable distribution statute, and Illinois will protect people. So most states will enforce prenups. They are very hard to get at. The usual grounds for getting out of it is if one of the parties doesn't have a lawyer, and a lawyer doesn't review the agreement. That's a real problem. And so you must make sure that both parties have lawyers. Another issue would be if you don't give your spouse anything in a prenup. And in New York, you have to be careful. You can't, even with people with wealth, you should not have a prenup that doesn't provide for some economic benefit.
Robert, last question I had for you is they're releasing the remake of the movie The War of the Roses, the old Kathleen Turner, Michael Douglas movie. They're remaking it, releasing it this summer. One of the greatest movies ever about divorce. What's, again, without naming names, like, what's the wackiest thing you've seen clients fight about? I mean, there's all sorts of famous stories about people fighting over, you know, these ultra wealthy fighting over the smallest of things. Give us a story that would amuse us without naming any names.
So one of the issues is an animal, a pet animal, becomes a crazy issue. And in a lot of jurisdictions, they don't provide for who gets custody of an animal. There are plenty of laws about how the kids get split up, but not animal kids. So that's an issue that we often really fight about. And I've had cases in which they split time with a dog, one week with the husband and another week with the ex-wife. So there's actually a turnover of the dog, and that's probably the craziest thing I've seen, or omitting any benefit by a wealthy person to the person they're marrying. You should not have an agreement that doesn't provide for something. It's just really not. And finally, the thing that you should have to be very careful if you represent wealth, which we often do, is not to make the spouse that's coming into the marriage with somebody with great wealth, not to make them part of any business. You know, you couldn't make it romantically. You couldn't make it sexually. You couldn't make it work. They're never going to be good business partners. And you have to be careful to protect all those business assets for the person who has that. You can provide plenty of money, but don't split up the business. Don't provide that the spouse becomes a partner in the event of a divorce. I think that would be a terrible mistake. And I would work very hard to talk my client out of doing that kind of arrangement.
Robert, Rich and Tina are both lawyers, and I'm a journalist, so I want you to name names. So maybe you could name some of the names, or maybe we could name some of the names off air and really help us fill in some of these gaps here.
So I represent very high net worth people. I've represented Melinda Gates. I represented Melinda Gates in a recent divorce from Bill Gates. I've represented Rupert Murdoch recently in his last divorce. And Mike Bloomberg and a number of very important people in finance, because so many people live in New York with significant wealth from finance. You know, when I was a kid, growing up in Coney Island in New York, if somebody had $100,000, they had a lot of money. And that was a while back. Today, the starting point is $1 billion, and the biggest asset is probably a brand new airplane, brand new shiny airplane, with a captain and a co-captain. So the world has changed very drastically. A lot to have to do with the stock market, which has been breaking new records every day now, and just keeps going up. So the wealth keeps growing, and that's why I said earlier in the interview that anybody with wealth must have a preemie.
You must have an incredible amount of stories. Attorney Robert Cohen, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
I appreciate the time and thank you for wanting to interview me.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined by Greg McGovern, a claims manager of commercial casualty and auto at Seneca Insurance Company. New York born and bred, Greg, is that correct?
Yes, sir. Born in Brooklyn, New York, and I live in Staten Island now.
Beautiful. Love it. And then we got Marshall Galinsky, a shareholder at Anderson's Kills Boston office and practices in the firm's insurance recovery and commercial litigation groups. Marshall is co-chair of the firm's sexual harassment and abuse insurance recovery group and sports media and entertainment group, and is a member of the firm's banking and lending group and restaurant, retail, and hospitality group. It all fits nicely on a business card. All right, fellas, we've got Boston versus New York going into this one. Let's get at it. We begin with Trump Watch, an illegal win at the U.S. Supreme Court for Trump and the administration when it comes to the federal workforce reductions. Rich, you threw this into the bag for us.
Besides that, you know, the big legal news yesterday with the Trump administration was the announcement that the DOJ, who, remember, is supposed to be the nation's lawyer, not the president's personal vendetta lawyer, is going after, you know, a story now that's like, what, 7 years old, going after former FBI Director Comey and the former National Intelligence Director, dealing with the Russia Gate scandal. So the DOJ is apparently going after them. It was news to both of them. So, you know, perhaps another example of Trump treating the cabinet like his own personal vendetta squad. But we'll move on to what is in our rundown, which is a victory, yes, Tina, for the Trump administration. Another victory. They've had a good couple of weeks here. Not surprising given the makeup of the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court basically held 8-1 with Ketanji Brown Jackson being the lone dissenter, that they could cut federal jobs. They had the authority to do so in the recent wave of DOGE cuts. And the court said that they have the authority to do that. And Justice Jackson in the dissent said that they were taking a wrecking ball to the government. This is impeding on congressional authority. It's especially relevant, Tina, I think, in the wake of what we saw happen in the Hill Country in Texas with the floods. There are many people who are making a connection between the decrease in federal workforce, particularly in the National Weather Service, and the failure to predict and react to the floods before this disastrous, what, almost 200 people died. So I'm not saying there's a connection there. I think there's investigation needs to be done. The White House right away said no, they were actually overstaffed in that department. But, you know, perhaps there is a nexus between cutting federal workers and, you know, disasters that require federal assistance.
Rich, taking that horrible story out of Texas first, you know, there are some stories that seem to indicate that those camps that suffered the greatest tragedies weren't even on maps defining flood zones. And so you have to wonder how that even is the case. But with regard to this decision by the Supreme Court, Jackson's dissent was very strong, very vehement. I think the only potential, I wouldn't call it a loophole, but maybe limitation of this decision is that I think the decision was with regard to the actual executive order itself. But I guess technically there's still the ability to challenge the implementation of these cuts on an agency by agency basis. So it'll be interesting to see if that ends up happening. But I agree with you that the administration has been on the victory side of the equation quite a bit the last few weeks in particular.
Marshall, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the cutting of the federal workforce, I mean, it seems logical to me that that would be part of the chief executive of the country's authority. That's basically what the court held.
Yeah, I thought Justice Jackson's dissent was, you know, thorough and enlightening. In that the way she framed it, this is a question of whether the president has the constitutional authority to rewrite, to basically redo entirely what Congress has the authority to do in terms of the establishment of these regulatory bodies. And so it's what the point she was making was that's a fact-intensive question, and so let's defer to the district court judge who's presiding over the facts. And I think ultimately, you know, the evidence that's created in the district court and reviewed by the Ninth Circuit will prevail. The only question that was before the Supreme Court was whether there was going to be a stay in place while that reassessment on appellate review is taking place. And, you know, what clearly is a victory for the Trump administration, because you can't, it's harder to unring the bell, right? You know, Justice Jackson called it a wrecking ball, and, you know, that's not a crazy way of putting it, although it got a lot of attention. Once the you know, people get fired, it's harder to hire them back. But that's essentially what would have to happen if either piece by piece, as Christina's suggesting, or wholesale, there's a determination that the mass firings were unconstitutional, which could happen.
It's consistent with the ruling in the birthright citizenship case that a single federal court judge can't decide, you know, this wide sweeping procedure for the entire country.
But partly I wonder, you know, if this court is going to be delivering wins over and over and over again to the Trump administration, or whether what they're doing is kind of a savvy political move where they deliver a win in a context like this, which is procedural to a certain extent, and then in other instances, rule on substance against the Trump administration, at least to create the appearance of some, you know, equanimity in their decisions overall. Well, who knows? And I'm no Supreme Court. I'm not a constitutional law scholar by any stretch, but it's of interest to me and any other lawyer in the country, that's for sure.
All right, moving along, two attorneys who represent MyPillow's CEO have been sanctioned by a federal judge in Colorado for using dozens of fake citations in a brief that was apparently generated by AI. Tina, what's going on here?
So, Ryan, this is a big week in terms of a story that we've been covering here a lot on Legal Face-Off, which is the use of AI in the law, particularly in the courtroom and in motions, and some of the limitations that exist. And as you said, MyPillow's CEO, Mike Lindell's attorneys were just sanctioned $3,000 each by a Colorado federal judge over a response brief that apparently included nearly 30 defective citations after using artificial intelligence. Those defects included misquoted, cited cases, misrepresentations of legal principles and case laws, and citations to cases that don't exist in the first place. This is the case involving Dominion Voting Systems executive Eric Coomer, who filed a defamation lawsuit against Lindell, his company MyPillow, and his website Frank Speech, accusing Lindell of amplifying false claims that Coomer had rigged the 2020 election against Donald Trump. The story gets really interesting when the judge ordered the attorneys to explain why they shouldn't be sanctioned, particularly since one of the attorneys failed to even admit in the first instance that he had used AI during the pretrial conference when the judge specifically asked him whether he had used it in drafting the brief. Interestingly, he said that he was on vacation in Mexico, had spotty internet service, and wasn't able to closely review the brief and the version that it was filed with the court. The judge proved him wrong by looking at the various timestamps on the filing when they tried to defend themselves and said that this kind of thing never happened to them before. The judge then went and showed that there were at least a couple of other instances where this type of thing has happened before. You know, as I mentioned, Ryan, this is not the only story. There was a divorce case out of Georgia where the hallucinations of AI were not caught until the Georgia Court of Appeals in this divorce case flagged them. The lower court judge had actually rendered a decision based off of fake cases. The trial judge had accepted The husband's argument in this case that was based on fake cases, the wife on appeal had argued that the order should be void on its face because fake cases were cited in reaching the conclusion. And when the husband appealed the decision, he cited to more additional fake cases. So, Rich, we have a lot of fun talking about these cases, especially ones involving hallucinations. I'm just hoping that our fellow attorneys start getting a little smarter about how they litigate, because these are the types of things that people can lose their licenses over.
You know, I mean, the greatest part is the guy's asking for sanctions and he cites two cases that don't exist either. I mean, it, you can't make this stuff up. And yeah, you know, listen, I tell younger attorneys all the time, there's an easy way, there's a hard way. Never pick the easy way. It's hard for a reason. And this is just an example of lazy lawyering. You know, technology has made it easier than ever to be lazy, but that's all it is. It's a tale as old as time. Greg, you employ hundreds, thousands maybe of attorneys. You see all sorts of work products, some of it very lazy. Are you seeing an upswing? I mean, can you tell when lawyers that are sending you product are using AI?
No, actually, and to be honest with you, I never thought of it until I started reading these articles, how AI would apply to fake, you know, citations of real cases or just completely made up cases at all. But it's something to start thinking about now. I mean, AI in general, I think, is a little scary, how fast that it's progressing in general. But when it comes to case law and stuff, it's even more, you know, daunting that, you know, luckily, yes, some lawyers and judges have done their due diligence and picked up on this stuff, right? But how many have gone under the radar? How many decisions have been made without picking up on this, right? So if they've caught a few, there has to be some that's gone under the radar. And I think attorneys in general, you know, and I, as far as, you know, we're concerned at our company, I think we're going to start having our attorneys more so scrutinize any citations that are made by opposing counsel and whatnot, and really, you know, start looking for this stuff a lot more.
Marshall, I think I was a victim of this. Literally yesterday, I was arguing with an attorney and he sent me a case citation that I looked up all the regular ways you would look up. I even used ChatGPT to look it up. I couldn't find anything. So are you seeing this kind of thing happen in your practice?
My practice, no, but we see news stories about it all the time. What I do is I represent policyholders in disputes with insurance companies, and I'm leading a team of lawyers at our firm that are paying really close attention to how insurance companies might end up using AI in their operations, right? But as a lawyer, as a practitioner, you see this story all the time, and it scares the bejesus out of you to think that there's not more people in the bar that are cautious about this type of thing. I think you're exactly right with what you said, Rich. This is what lawyers get paid to do, is do the analysis, think clearly about it, and be upfront and clear and accurate with the court. I mean, our judicial system depends on this, right? But laziness is a human tendency. And to do something faster, our clients want us to do things faster and more efficiently. So there are incentives built into leveraging AI to help you do a better job and do it more efficiently. But to succumb to, you know, outright misstatements and things that you present to the court is just a grievous error that has to be avoided. There's another interesting from a legal practitioning perspective. I think all lawyers are going to adapt and start to use AI. Hopefully, they're all going to use it very well to make their work better and more efficient. But there's an interesting question among practitioners of, is the use of AI, especially by younger lawyers, going to make them worse lawyers? Right? Like anything that you get really good at, you get really good at it by doing all of it. Thinking carefully about what the law is, what it should be, what it isn't. Thinking really carefully what the facts are in your case. And you build up a compendium of knowledge about the law and the facts. And lawyers who have a command over that information, they're really good lawyers. Now, if you're using AI to shortcut a lot of this stuff, do you end up a less good lawyer? And I think that's a really interesting thing from a legal practitioner perspective. We're going to find out over the next 10 or 20 years who's able to do this type of AI tool using really well.
just crossed the wire that Elon Musk's AI chatbot Grok, which did not have a very good week last week, is going to launch in Tesla vehicles. So not only for lawyers, but your cars will also be operating on AI. Fantastic. That sounds like that'll work out for everyone. All right, Rich, in New York, they're looking to legalize bodega cats. Can't wait to hear Greg's take on this one here.
I mean, who knew this was an issue that is worthy of legislation? For those of our listeners that don't know, a bodega is basically a convenience store in New York. That's what they call them there, selling all manner of alcohol and candy and always pretty good delis inside those bodegas. All the more reason, Tina, not to have a freaking cat running around the store. I don't know about you. I don't want a cat jumping in the salad bar when I'm trying to get, you know, my midday Caesar. But this council member, Keith Powers, who's also, I think, running for borough president of Brooklyn, perhaps one of the boroughs, Keith Powers, he introduced legislation on Friday to legalize bodega cats. So it means that currently there's like a million illegal bodega cats, I guess, running around New York City. It would make it legal to have cats in the bodega, which I guess is a thing. I didn't know. I've been to a million bodegas in New York. I never saw a cat or thought it was a thing, but I guess it's a thing to have a cat in the bodega team. They would also offer free vaccination programs to cats. And I guess it's widely popular, this legislation, because many fans of bodega cats, as evidenced by TikTok and Instagram. I'm looking at one page right now, Bodega Cats of Instagram, and there's a lot of cats at bodegas.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, first of all, I'm a lover of cats and dogs, and I have a few cats. And so I do think there's a...
What? Yeah, let's just say it all out. You're a bit of a cat lady.
I'm not a cat lady. But I have to say that I do think there's a way to make this business proposition work where you keep the cats away from the food, from anything that would be, I guess, inappropriate to have cats lingering around. And my guess is that when you do a cost-benefit analysis, there's a huge rat problem, huge mouse problem, and cats do a really good job of taking care of all of that. You know, the question in my mind is, if it catches on in New York, why not do it in other major metropolitan areas like Chicago? I mean, we may not call them bodegas here, but we sure have a bunch of convenience stores around here.
It's lockdownchicagobodegacat.com. Greg, this is your venue.
Yeah.
First of all, in your favorite bodega where you're getting your egg and cheese sandwich, is there a cat, and do you object or support this legislation?
So I on Staten Island, you know, where I live, there aren't too many. I haven't seen too many.
Instead, it's just big rats is running around.
Yeah. On Staten Island, I really haven't seen too many of these bodega cats. When I lived in Brooklyn for 19 years. And then I moved. I was in Queens for a couple of years, and now I'm in Staten Island. But in Brooklyn and Queens primarily is where I saw them. And I saw them quite frequently. When I was a young man in Brooklyn, every deli or bodega you go into had them. And I guess it never dawned on me until now why they were there is for pest control. It never really hit me. But I would just assume they were a stray cat that walked in. The owner said, all right, you could stay. But we used to see them. They'd be laying on the shelves, right? I mean, everything's packaged and whatnot. They weren't by, like, I never really remember seeing them by the deli, by cold cuts or anything like that. But they'd be on the store shelves on loaves of bread, cans of whatever, olives, peas, or what, you know, stuff like that, just hanging around. And they typically didn't bother anybody, but they were just always there. And they're a staple of the New York deli or bodega. I think I support the legislation. Yeah, this guy right there, who's Bodega. I got to check out that Instagram, Bodega Cats of Instagram. I support the legislation. I think it's a good thing if they could get vaccinated and there could be some sort of measures put in place to make sure that they're not laying on open food or stuff that's unpackaged, rather. I'm all for it. I ate at those bodegas for many, many years, and I never got sick. I'm all right.
I lived on the Lower East Side for like about 12 years in a Dominican neighborhood, and I never saw a cat in the bodega across the street from our apartment. When I saw this, the first thing that occurred to me is, why are legislators basically taking action to to ride the wake of Instagram pet watching stuff. Like, there's got to be more important things to do. It seemed to me the only reason why anyone's taking this up is because people like watching cute little kittens on social media feeds. And, you know, someone decided, oh, I'm going to get a little political clout for doing something that Instagram addicted people like to look at. It's just kind of weird.
Cats have been used for decades to protect food sources, even at stadiums. Occasionally you'll see a cat run through a stadium and be like, how the heck did that cat get into that stadium? It's usually to keep the pests away. So it's nailed it, Tina. Good job. Sometimes using a big retailer for IP infringement can actually backfire on you. Suing, I should say. Sometimes suing a big retailer can backfire on you. And Tina, it looks like that's the case with Lululemon and Costco.
Ryan, so we've covered a number of stories like this here on Legal Face-Off over the years. This one involves Lululemon that filed a lawsuit against Costco, accusing Costco of selling unauthorized lookalikes of some of its popular clothing items, including scuba hoodies, jackets, and ABC pants, which Costco sells under the Kirkland brand. Costco claims that these items, only to the extent that there are similarities with the Lululemon items, that they are particular qualities and characteristics of the clothes that actually any number of similar competitive items from other companies have. The Lululemon lawsuit claims that these are essentially lower price dupes akin to counterfeits, which mislead consumers and can harm Lululemon's brand. They're trying to stop Costco from selling these and are trying to recover damages. They're claiming violations of trademark as well as design patents. What's really interesting is when you do a side-by-side and you look at some of the pictures that are included in the lawsuit, which we are going to look at here, first of all, not particularly clear without the labels whose item is whose. Second, some of these clothing items look pretty wrinkled. I'm not quite sure that we put our best foot forward here when putting together these pictures. But as we've also seen,
these are actually from the complaint.
I know, which is, as I mentioned, not necessarily putting our best foot forward, but also in my experience as an IP lawyer, both dealing with similar situations on my own, as well as watching them over the years, this kind of reminds me a little bit, Rich, of the North Face South Butt situation. Obviously a little bit different because that was more about the name rather than the actual look of the apparel. But it's one of those situations where you have to do a cost-benefit analysis as a company when you're filing complaints like this. Because if they backfire, not only do you not look so great in the court of public opinion, but you may actually start highlighting the goods and services of the company that you're suing. And so in this instance, it looks like Costco's apparel is getting maybe even more attention than it otherwise would have, Rich, without the lawsuit.
Yeah. We've covered a lot. I mean, these dupe lawsuits are never going away. And, you know, like, there's a line between, obviously, we've seen some extreme examples of what seems to be copying the, you know, likeness, the brand, even the logo of some products. There's a line between that and I think what's going on here, which is, like, it's inevitable. Kirkland's not the only company. Costco's not the only company that is producing products that are similar to Lululemon. Guess what? Lululemon's incredibly successful. It has been for many years. It's also very expensive. So along with that, and inventing, sort of, they invented a new category like athletic leisure, there's going to be a bunch of knockoffs. And whether they are copying the brand enough to succeed in litigation is the question. But you could put up like 10 other companies. I can rattle them off that are producing, you know, pants similar to these ABC pants. And are they going to succeed against all these other companies? No, because it's natural that when you're producing a new category, there's going to be competitors who are producing similar products. So I don't think that this will be successful? Because again, you're shopping at Costco. You know that it's Kirkland. I mean, most people who shop at Costco are pretty savvy and they are very familiar with the Kirkland brand. That's part of why they're shopping there. So they know they're not buying Lululemon pants. They know they're buying Kirkland. That's it. End of story for I think a lot of this litigation. But Greg, are you a fan of the athletic leisure pants?
Not so much. I'm a fan of Costco and the Kirkland brand in general of their clothes. I've never purchased or worn Lululemon, and I have no background or experience with IP infringement or anything like that. But I mean, I would like to know exactly how far off the product has to be, how different it has to be. Obviously, if it's a one-to-one clone, I would imagine that's an issue. But I would like to see how this plays out. And like Christina said, you know, this might very well backfire on Lululemon. You know, it'll send people in droves to Costco saying, oh, I'm going to get these pants a lot cheaper.
Yeah. And Marshall, to Tina's point, I mean, just as sort of a complaint drafting lesson, like one of the allegations that there is special anti-wrinkle technology. I don't know, maybe spend a minute ironing the damn pants before you attach the photos that are here. Not these, but the ones in the pants that are all wrinkled. How good could that technology be?
It would have been nice if maybe we had a way, instead of putting up the pictures, of Rich having you model some of the clothes in the podcast. That could have been an effective way of helping people get a gist for what the stuff is all about. Basically, this was a big news story. There are a lot of major news outlets covering this lawsuit, which made me wonder, how did it become a big news story, right? Like the same quotes of the Lululemon folks were quoted in a statement over and over again by AP and the New York Times and the Post and other people like that. And it made me wonder, who put out a press release about the lawsuit? And is there a larger business play here, right? Is Lululemon filing the lawsuit, expecting that they're going to resolve it as part of some partnership with Costco going forward? You know, it's strange that it got so much press attention, because everyday lawsuits usually don't, especially for, you know, athletic wear.
Greg, the Lululemon's at the Staten Island Mall. It's between Ulta and Dave and Buster's. But I also see where Costco is. It's not that far away. So if you're looking for cheaper ones.
Staten Island Mall has been closed since 1987.
Closes at 8 o'clock tonight. I just looked it up.
Good luck going there tonight after dark.
Yeah, no, I haven't been to the mall in a while. I was at Costco a few days ago, though. I live
there. You go.
You go there tonight, Ryan or Greg. What we're about to cover is going to happen to you. I promise.
Yeah. All right, yeah, let's go to that. All right, so
stabbed with glass from a mason jar, for Christ's sake.
Brawls can begin at the mall, perhaps, over money, girls, cars, Jordans. But Rich, you found this story out of LA about a brawl outside of a GameStop, and I'll look and see if there's a GameStop at the Staten Island Mall. Started by what?
Pokemon. I mean, you know, Marshall does a lot of retail and restaurant work. I do a ton of it. I defend a lot of lawsuits where fights break out. Greg does a lot of that too, where fights break out in retail stores, and you know, the plaintiffs end up suing the retail store. The most seemingly friendliest places on earth are the sites of the craziest fights. You know, I've done a lot of work for Chuck E. Cheese. I can mention them by name because these lawsuits are all over the media. Don't go to be careful when you go to Chuck E. Cheese in certain parts of the country after six, particularly if they sell alcohol. Similarly, this GameStop, which is supposed to be a place where, you know, kids are going out and trying their new video games and collecting stuff, was the site of this brawl where a guy, by the way, a 49-year-old guy, allegedly smacked the victim in the back of the head, not with like a controller or a doll or something, but a glass mason jar. What's the guy doing bringing a glass mason jar, Tina, to a GameStop? The victim was, and then another guy, a 27-year-old, picked up the shard of glass and stabbed the victim over this Pokemon dispute. So I don't know. I don't play Pokemon, never have, don't understand a second of it, but apparently it's making people angry enough to stab each other with glass.
So these guys were standing outside in line, and the only thing that I can immediately think of as a reason for mason jars, if these guys thought the line was going to, they were going to be in line so long that they needed a plan B to go to the bathroom. Like, I don't know. Yeah. And second of all, if you Google Pokemon and brawl or Pokemon and fights. These things apparently happen with people who are big Pokemon fans. Like, they're going around inciting violence in front of stores, in front of GameStops. I mean, like, I don't know what it is about this sort of segment of our population, but it seems like they're pretty cantankerous, I guess.
Greg, one of the charges, in addition to assault with a deadly weapon, battery, one of the charges that was made against these two individuals who were tracked down was conspiracy to commit a crime. So I don't know, were these guys like at home before they went off to the GameStop and thought, here's what happened. We're going to hope we get this card. But if we don't, you grab the mason jar, I'll get the glass, and we'll do a stabbing spree. That they were conspiring apparently beforehand. But
yeah,
you love Pokemon. Tell us about the attraction here.
I've never gotten into Pokemon or played the cards or watched the show. But from what I understand, it's you know, especially with a lot of older folks nowadays, it's the cards. They get the cards in order to resell them. It's not about playing anything. It's a big resale market. And what comes to mind is a lot of stories that I'm hearing in local, like, stores like Target or wherever these cards are sold. People are waiting there and just waiting for them to stock the shelves and then wiping them out. And if anybody gets in their way, they're fighting. It's I don't know if they're bringing mason jars and conspiring to use those as weapons, but this is definitely happening. It's like the Wild West when it comes to Pokemon cards.
Greg, there's a GameStop located between the Kids Foot Locker and Adore Me, a lingerie store at Staten Island Mall. So,
by the way, there's a cat adoption center in the mall too.
There are three bodegas there, so it's weird. All right. This is one of those kind of sad stories about a person we all loved and adored whose life is seemingly kind of spiraled. Rich, tell us about the legal trouble of Olympic gold medalist Mary Lou Retton.
Yeah, I mean, you know, America's sweetheart from, what was it, 84 or 80? Yeah, I think it was 84 Olympics. Multiple medal winner, you know, won the hearts of America when she did her gymnastics and had a bright smile and was on the cover of Wheaties and all that. She was arrested this week for DUI, and the video was widely, of course, these videos always get, you know, circulated and millions of views. And, you know, first she said, oh, I'm not going with you and I'm not drunk. And then she later apologized and admitted that she had a lapse of judgment. Video is not a great look for a former Olympian. You know, she failed this field sobriety test. Police were very nice to her, I thought, if you look at the body cam. And, you know, she was taken away. She was, you know, she referenced her 8 shoulder surgeries as perhaps a reason she couldn't be handcuffed. But, you know, at the end of the day, she was in the wrong here. They found a bottle of alcohol. I think it was wine in her car. And we're going to look at the video. I think, Tina, it was interesting to see some of the reactions online. You know, there was almost an equal amount of people sympathizing with her and said, just leave her alone. And, you know, but it doesn't matter who you are. DUI is not this is pretty serious.
Don't lift your arms for balance, okay? Wait till I tell you to begin.
Oh, my God.
You may begin whenever you're ready.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, my God.
Keep trying.
5, 6, 7.
Keep going. I'll tell you when to stop.
Oh, cool.
Keep going.
We can cut it. We can cut it. I mean, she fails the field sobriety test. She's a little belligerent with the police, you know, as belligerent as Mary Lou Retton could be, famously very nice. But what was your take, Tina? Is this, should this have even seen the light of day? I mean, you know, I think kind of the bigger picture is all of us being fascinated with these mugshots and body cam videos and so forth. We certainly cover a lot of it, so we're guilty of it.
And I just think it's extraordinarily sad. I mean, I think a lot of us grew up watching Mary Lou Retton. I mean, she was a phenom. I mean, I remember watching her back when I was either was junior high or high school. And I think that this saw the light of day, Rich, to your point, because she is so incredibly famous. And it's just really sad. I mean, I think that she's clearly not well. You know, she had that bout with pneumonia a couple of years ago that I remember reading the headlines back then where the doctors were saying that they had, I think they said she had a less than 50% chance of recovering. And, you know, she's drinking an open bottle of wine in a car, like in a parking lot. And so I just feel very sad. And it's just, you know, the bigger picture comment is that when these celebrities end up, you know, sort of in the twilight of their career or completely, you know, not doing anything that makes them famous any longer, they have no privacy, right? And so I think that that sort of just feeds it all.
Well, yeah. But Marshall, you know, you benefit from the celebrity as she did. You should probably also, you know, suffer from it when you're caught driving while intoxicated.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Tina on this. You know, if there's one thing that so many of these, you know, stories we've talked about, the most recent ones have in common, is that there's a video. You know, if there wasn't a video of Mary Lou Retton sitting in the parking lot, you know, at one point in the video, she's walking heel to toe down a yellow line of a parking spot, right? We all know Mary Lou Retton walking, you know, and doing backflips on a balance beam, right? And so there's something that, you know, is kind of like sick comedy that someone decided that they would try to capitalize on. But yeah, I'm with Tina, you know, a little privacy here goes a long way. There's not much to this. People make mistakes. She owned up to it. I think it's kind of unseemly to take shots at her.
Well, let's be clear. She owned up to it after the release of the video. Her first reaction on video is that I'm not going with you. You're not arresting me. So, you know, there's two sides to that. Greg, what's your thoughts on it?
So, I mean, I kind of echo that. It is sad. I don't really remember her. I wasn't born yet, but I do remember. I've seen the clips of her, and she's the one that stuck the landing, and right, and it was all great. Yeah, that thing. So I remember I've seen clips of it, but you know, I do think it's sad too. You know, everybody makes mistakes, and to have it highlighted and plastered across the national media, especially however many almost 40 years after, you know, the highlight of your career happened, it's kind of, you know, it's not so much like you're in the spotlight anymore, and you know, you're the star of some upcoming movie, and this happened, and it's a big scandal. I mean, she's 40 years out from her celebrity. I don't know. I think maybe this one could have been not as widely publicized.
Yeah. You know, she was driving a Tesla, and with that new AI, maybe we don't drive drunk. No, I'm serious. That could end up being a thing someday. Maybe the bots take over, and we don't have to worry about drunk driving anymore. I don't know. We'll see. Sure. All right. I love this.
Or misciting legal authorities. You could have the Tesla drive around for you and accurately cite legal authority while you're drinking the wine out of the bottle.
There you go. I wonder if you'd have to be in the passenger seat, though. I wonder if how that would work. We'd have to find out. All right. Love this last story, being the husband of a teacher, because give a teacher some alcohol and they'll say all the things that they've wanted to say and do all the things they want to do. Rich, tell us about this teacher from the UK.
Yeah, from our UK edition of Legal Face-Off, this story comes from Wales, where this teacher allegedly was drunk. She was chugging booze, Tina, from a water bottle full of orange liquid, which smelled of alcohol. She was blasting music from her laptop during a health class, according to one of the children, one of the students, a 16-year-old. She was calling the kids little shits, and perhaps the worst offense of all was making them dance the Macarena.
Wow. Now, you know, that's from like 30 years ago.
Greg might not remember, but that's the worst offense.
Yeah, I don't know if Greg was born then.
I remember that. I was around for
that. With that horrible dance. That's to me the worst part of the story, is trying to bring back the damn Macarena.
Big time.
Yeah, it was. Rich, I mean, this story is hilarious, but I want to hear Ryan's take on this. It's not hilarious when you're doing this in front of students that you're supposedly teaching and who are impressionable. This is like what not to do. I think I would love to see her in a bar and hang out with her, but that's not what this story is all about. This story is about her doing this in the classroom.
Yeah, you know, give them a little bit of boost. They'll say those words. They'll say what they really think. They won't do it at school, but they'll do it in this kind of set. Don't do it at school, though.
All right. Well, let's end off our roundtable with, I mean, we'll have to all do our version of the Macarena, maybe.
Oh boy.
This is maybe a tough one, but what I'm happy to see the Macarena gone. What is the trend in history that you miss the least? What are you happiest about to see in the rear view? Let's start with Marshall. Marshall, what, like the Macarena, what are you happy to never see come back again, be it by a drunk Welsh teacher or anyone else? Good riddance to what, per Marshall?
I'm going to defer. Can I defer and bond to this?
Okay, you can, I guess. Are you deferring till the end of the segment?
Yes, I'll defer to the end of the segment.
Greg.
Are we specific to the legal industry? Is that the question?
Anything like the Macarena that you're happy to say sayonara to?
All right, I'll go. It's similar. It's in the same vein as the Macarena, but I remember at, you know, every party that I had gone to in the 90s and whatnot, birthdays and communions and what have you, there was always the electric slide, the chicken dance, all these hokey, horrible songs and dances that I absolutely hated. And I'm glad that they have not made a resurgence. I hope they never do. I'm going with that. I'm going with those dances.
And the electric slide never went out because any bat mitzvah, bar mitzvah, wedding, they're still playing the electric slide all the time.
I haven't seen it. Thank
you. What? Maybe, is there any non-dance answers that you could come up with of things that you are glad are no longer around in 2025?
Yes. Members only jackets.
Oh, damn. Go to my closet. For those of you that don't know, members only jacket was a jacket that had a little label that said members only. It was a very specific type of jacket worn mostly by guys 78 years old or older. But it had a certain cachet. It was a status symbol for a little while there.
All right. I've got one here. Do you guys
have one?
Do you guys remember oxy pads? Did you guys ever use those as a teenager if you had acne?
Oh, my God.
I don't think they really do it anymore, but basically you were throwing rubbing alcohol on your face and it would burn your face and burn your eyes. And for me, it never actually worked. The kids have much more subtle face cleanser, as I've seen with my daughter, but I remember those and oh, that was awful.
Yeah, the FDA probably outlawed those because they like burn through two layers of skin.
Yes.
Yeah, those were painful. Marshall, do you want us to come back or are you still thinking?
So similar to this kind of remember the 80s vibe, there was this fashion in sports uniforms that kind of popped up in about 15 years ago of like teal, like bright green and teal colors. I never understood at the time that it came up why this was kind of a good way of selling more jerseys.
The Florida Marlins.
I'm thinking of the San Jose Sharks, for example, or the Seahawks had these bright green neon colors in the uniforms. Like and I guess some of these like city select jerseys were revisiting some of these neat, like I'm thinking of the Padres jerseys with the bright like orange and pink and purplish color in it. Like get rid of all of those. Like never liked those, right? They have kind of an iridescent glow in the dark quality to it that I just don't need to see like athletes running around quickly with.
That's good. You know, as this category is made for me, as a misanthrope, as a malcontent, I could go for hours on stuff that makes me angry that are no longer around. But like, I don't know, remember the trend of crystal drinks, clear drinks? That was so stupid. Remember talk to the hand. I never want to hear that term again. Remember not, right? It's really glad to see you. I'm really happy to see you. Not, that was awful. Or similar to that, Tina is way. And, you know, no way, way. By the way, President Trump is bringing that back. Did you hear the release of his discussion where he said to the leader, allegedly, he says that I told the leaders of Russia and China that I'm going to bomb their capital cities. He alleges that he told Putin, I'm going to bomb Moscow. And what do you think the leader of Moscow said, according to Trump? He said, no way. And Trump said, way? How are two of the most powerful using this dumb term from Wayne's World?
Here's another one. Word.
Word.
Word. How about da bomb? You use the word right there, bomb.
All that and a bag of chips.
Yes.
That's good. Rich, that was a great Andy Rooney moment. I think this could be a good installment for the segment going forward. You know, Rich just kind of ends with his grumpy old man.
Man yells at clouds.
I love it.
In my day. All right, Lisa, you got anything to add as we sign off?
I hated when the women with the shoulder pads. I hated those
clothes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And always the tightly rolled jeans. That was another one.
I still love that. I'd do that now if it came back.
Acid wash that turns like yellow. Mm-hmm.
I would dance like MC Hammer and I would roll my pants and I would wear big Florida Marlins 1995 jerseys backwards like the band Criss Cross.
Ryan, did you wear your hair like Buster Poindexter?
I had soccer player hair, you know, right down the middle. It was flowing. It was glorious. Now it's a struggle every morning. All right. Well, thank you very much, Marcia Galinsky and Greg McGovern. And that will do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Greg's got some shopping to do at the mall. Special thanks to Christopher Berry with the Non-Human Rights Project, Belen Myers with Belen Myers Law, attorney Robert Cohen with Cohen, Claire, Lands, Griefer, and Simpson, Paul Eccles with the Brandeis Center, and also we got a shout-out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegall. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Brian Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.